Well, good evening. If you want to turn to 2 Kings chapter 18, this is where we'll continue our study in 2 Kings as we hurling toward the end of Judah and the deportation of God's people into Babylonian exile. So we've seen how the kingdom has divided and the northern kingdom has fallen into apostasy, and eventually the judgment of God carried them off at the hands of the Assyrians, and the lessons not learned by the southern kingdom of Judah, and they fall into idolatry as well. And although they have a few good kings that kind of put off the day of reckoning, the day comes and they'll be carried off into captivity as well. So I want to kind of do a rough overview of where we're going with this period in the reign of Hezekiah. The first several verses of chapter 18, I'm assuming y'all already covered last week. So we will start with verse 13, when the Sennacherib besieges Jerusalem. And so you remember, this is the series of Assyrian emperors we've had that really starts with Tiglath-Pileser in 745. And each one of these is mentioned in Scripture, some of them several times. And so Tiglath-Pileser begins the expansion of Assyrian power. And again, you just have to see the hand of God in this. This is divine providence that a nation could rise so powerfully and just seem like they're unstoppable. Nobody can thwart them. And so Shalmaneser V, although his was a short reign, he was the one responsible for besieging the capital city of Samaria, of the northern kingdom of Israel. And after a three-year siege, it fell. And that marks the end of the northern kingdom, 722-721. Shalmaneser actually dies at the same time. Doesn't seem to be related. But Sargon then mops up things and deports the people. He dies in battle. And, of course, you have this tendency that when an emperor dies, his subjects rebel. This is the opportunity for all these nations that have been conquered by the Assyrians to say, well, surely this emperor will not be as powerful or as mean or as efficient as the previous emperor. And so every time one of these Assyrian emperors died, that's what happened. It happened when Shalmaneser died. It happened when Sargon died. So, but it turns out each successor seems to be even more powerful of anything, more vicious. And so Sennacherib's no exception to that. So in 705, Hezekiah has been paying tribute to the Assyrians. Judah has adopted a pro-Assyrian policy. That was Ahaz's doing, of course. Hezekiah inherited that from his father. But with the death of Sargon, hey, this is our chance. And of course, if enough people rebel, and Sennacherib's got so much rebellion on his hands all over the place, maybe you'll kind of go unnoticed or something. Puny little Judah over there, who cares? And Sennacherib has to spend a few years putting out fires all over the place. But in 701, he will have his affairs sufficiently in order to for Judah to take her turn being re-subjugated. And so that's the story that we're going to begin reading about here. So the year is 701 B.C. And this is just a map of the area we're dealing with here. The great expansion of Assyrian power all through this green area. And so they're, of course, they have eyes on Egypt. And so obviously Israel's right in the way. And that needs to come under Assyrian control as well. So that brings us to Hezekiah. And basically the story of Hezekiah is he's a righteous man, a good king, but he's imperfect. And what we would have studied in the first few verses of chapter 18 talk about his attempts at reform, how he is zealous, and so that's good as far as it goes. He is said to be like his father David. He trusted in Yahweh, God of Israel, so that, verse 5 says, after him there was none like him among all the kings of Judah, nor among those who were before him. Again, this is just rhetoric, right? That's just how the Hebrews had a way of talking. Kind of like we say, You know, everybody's going to be there. Well, we don't really mean everybody literally is going to be somewhere. And so this is the kind of thing that would be said. Is Hezekiah really a better king than David was? Or, you know, other kings you might think about? Or the same thing is said about Josiah later. There's no king like him before or after. Well, you can't have two kings that are the best compared to all those before and after. So, again, it's just to say he was outstanding, you know, compared to most of these other kings. But we do have to realize that he was a man. He made political calculations. And again, I'm not pointing the finger too harshly at the man. If I was responsible for ruling a nation and I had to deal with all of the political realities that Hezekiah did, and he's got all of these counselors and powerful families and so on who have some influence as well, you know, what do you do? And so you got people telling you to make an alliance with the Egyptians. You've got people telling you to make an alliance with the Babylonians. You got people telling you to, you know, make nice with the Assyrians. And then you've got Isaiah who says, don't make alliances with anybody. Just trust the Lord. Well, that's easy to say, you know, but this is the real world, you know. And you'll see Christians this way today. I've known Christian business people that when some other Christians might object that your business practices aren't very Christian, well, you're just idealistic. You're not realistic. You know, this is business. This is how the real world works in business. And it's really sad to see Christian principles get sacrificed because business comes first. And then if we can still be good Christians after being good businessmen, then we'll work that in somehow. But business has to come first. Well, you can appreciate the kind of pressure he's under. And pride is a thing that Hezekiah is particularly indicted for that we'll see later on. This is the third of the great reform movements that have been undertaken in Judah. And then Josiah's will be the fourth and final effort. And the sad story there, of course, is that these reform efforts don't last. They don't effectively work in terms of keeping the nation from going into captivity. So one of the things that's mentioned is he destroys Nehushtan, which is this Hebrew word, means bronze thing. You remember the bronze serpent that Moses had made that people would, you know, look up on this pole and be saved from their snake bites. Well, it worked, and then the people made it into an idol. So they'd kept it for hundreds of years now. And Hezekiah said, enough's enough, you know, we'll destroy that. And the various high places where people were worshiping. Second Chronicles particularly tells about Hezekiah's efforts to reinstate the Passover observance and to rebuild the temple, and that's part of his reform efforts and so on. So we've already mentioned the fact that he's rebelled at the death of Sargon around 705. He probably knows the Assyrians are going to come one day, knocking at his door, expecting to bring him back into line. And it's sometime around this time where we can't know exactly when the period of Hezekiah's sickness relates to this story, but that's told in chapter 20. In those days, that's just a kind of generic statement, Hezekiah became mortally ill, and Isaiah says, set your house in order, you're going to die from this sickness. And he, of course, Hezekiah prays, and so God tells Isaiah to go back and tell him he's got another 15 years. Well, because the story is told after God's deliverance of Jerusalem from Sennacherib and the Assyrian army, some people would assume, well, it comes after that time period. But you'll notice that part of what the message is that Isaiah is supposed to tell him in verse 6, I will deliver you in this city from the hand of the king of Assyria. I will defend this city for my own sake and for my servant David's sake. So it seems most likely that this sickness occurred prior to the siege of Jerusalem, or roughly about the same time. And who knows, maybe the sickness was something of a divine judgment against Hezekiah even. I mean, the word for boil that he's afflicted with is the same word used in Deuteronomy chapter 28, that God would smite the people with the boils of Egypt as a curse for the violation of the covenant, and so on. But the important thing here is it's after Hezekiah gets well that the Babylonians hear about this, and so the head of the Babylonians sends this embassy to Hezekiah to flatter him, and clearly what is behind this is some kind of overture to Judah to join an anti-Assyrian alliance, and it's part of a political shenanigans going on, and that accounts for why Isaiah is so upset about this and says, you just completely lost your mind here. And also, we know that Hezekiah is guilty of relying on Egypt, or at least hoping for help from Egypt, or currying assistance from Egypt. Now, a lot of this comes from Isaiah, the book of Isaiah. And when you read the book of Isaiah, it doesn't come out and say, Hezekiah did this and Hezekiah did that. What it does is it indicts the nation and the leadership of the nation in particular for all of these failures, seeking help from the Egyptians, relying upon your military strength and fortifying the city of Jerusalem, thinking that's what's going to deliver you. Well, Hezekiah was at least implicated in that. He's part of that. He's the king. So a lion's share of that criticism by Isaiah would fall in the lap of Hezekiah. So we can't fall into the simplistic view that Hezekiah is one of the good kings. He wears a white hat. Nothing he did was wrong. He was a failed a man with many problems. Now, the way Hebrew storytelling goes, of course, is we had in chapter 18 this kind of summary view that he is a good king. He's like his father David. He trusted the Lord. And so, nothing we say changes that, but it does qualify it. And of course, we've seen this often in Scripture before, where we'll get some summary statement like that. He did all that was right in the eyes of the Lord, and then the very next thing is you're told some story how he failed the Lord, didn't trust in the Lord. And you say, well, boy, that doesn't seem consistent. And again, you just have to understand it's their way of telling the story. Here's the general picture, but there are some exceptions to this, and that's how we're to read this and understand it. And so he does say that, yes, Hezekiah was a good man. When push comes to shove, he trusts the Lord when it counts, but he wasn't perfect. And what we have here is a story of his failure, but in spite of that failure, you can be redeemed from it. And I tell you, that's a great message because that's where all of us are. None of us are perfect, and we can't expect a relationship with God on that basis. We are flawed ourselves, but we don't need to despair. It's not hopeless. Our situation can be redeemed as well. And so there are a lot of preparations that Isaiah makes for the onslaught of the Assyrians that he knows is coming. And one of the things that's referred to is any of these local rulers, these little city states around that are pro-Assyrian, he's kind of arresting their leadership and deposing their kings and things like that and rebuilding the fortifications. And one of the big things he's known for is the securing of this water supply by digging this long tunnel. And that's even what is said at the very end of chapter 20. Now the rest of the acts of Hezekiah and all his might and how he made the pool and the conduit and brought water into the city, are they not written in the books of the chronicles of the kings of Judah? And so obviously this was a great engineering feat, even by today's standards, really. And so it was really noteworthy, and so that's one thing Hezekiah is really known for. But that was the reason why he was securing that water supply. You'll notice this seal impression here. This is one of a couple of seals that have been found that, if genuine, are the seal of Hezekiah, the son of Ahaz, king of Judah. And what's interesting is the imagery on them is distinctly Egyptian, which suggests part of that probably pro-Egyptian currying favor with the Egyptians and so on. So here are some different the efforts that Hezekiah is making. We're told about Paddy, who is the ruler of Ekron. He's handed over to Hezekiah. That's, again, part of that effort to suppress any kind of pro-Assyrian efforts going on. And note the location of Lachish or Lachish down here. This will be significant as the Assyrians try to come up to Jerusalem, approaching from the southwest, and they're going to besiege that city and take it, and that'll be a significant accomplishment. So here's some pictures of the Gihon Spring and the tunnel. So it's 1,800 feet long, some 150 feet underground. And there are, you know, guys chiseling through solid rock from both ends till they meet in the middle. You can imagine, how do you do that, you know? And the way they did it basically is, you know, there's some guy up on the land above, and they're whacking on the ground, and the guys inside have to listen where the pounding is loudest and figure out where to go from there. So we've already noted 2 Kings chapter 20, verse 20 refers to this. But look in Isaiah chapter 22, and this is a section in Isaiah that envisions the approach of the Assyrian army as it gets closer and closer to Jerusalem. And notice in Isaiah chapter 22, picking up verse 8, God has removed the defense of Judah. So this is all by divine providence. This is God's will. In that day, you depended on the weapons of the house of the forest. You saw that the breaches in the wall of the city of David were many. You collected the waters of the lower pool. You counted the houses of Jerusalem. You tore down houses to fortify the wall. You made a reservoir between the two walls for the waters of the old pool. But you did not depend on him who made it, nor did you take into consideration him who planned it long ago. And so you can see Isaiah the prophet, this is his criticism of the nation. You're making all these fortifications and securing of the water supply, and that's exactly one of the most prominent things that Hezekiah spent these years doing, preparing for the Assyrian siege. And Isaiah's indictment is, but you didn't trust the Lord, you know. So that's the ultimate failure of the people. So there's this inscription that was in the tunnel, and it got chiseled out and carted off. It's now in the, I think, a museum in Istanbul. But and it's a very old Hebrew script, obviously from the time of Hezekiah, and basically gives some detail about how the diggers, you know, chopped their way through the rock and met up and so on. But it was such an accomplishment, they commemorated it with this inscription. And so the whole point of this is, of course, you need a secure water supply if you're under siege. And so they blocked up any access to the Gihon Spring outside of the city. And then they dig this tunnel to funnel the water into the walled part of the city at the Pool of Siloam, where they would have access to the water then. And then Isaiah referred to the tearing down of houses and building up of the walls. Example of this is the so-called Broad Wall, portions of which have been excavated. This was built during the time of Hezekiah to try to strengthen the fortifications against the Assyrian onslaught, so you can get an idea of the size of that thing. So, you know, they're expecting a pretty serious assault by the Assyrians at that time. And then one other an interesting feature archaeologically is this prism, this cuneiform script, kind of six-sided cylinder. And there are actually two copies of these that have been found. So it's astounding enough you've got one, but you have two copies of the same document, which is the record of Sennacherib's exploits. So one's called the Sennacherib prism, the other's called the Thompson prism because of who it was discovered by. And what is described here is a two-pronged attack against the city of Jerusalem by the Assyrian forces, which is interesting because the prophet Micah has a section of text where several different cities are warned, bemoaning the approach of this judgment of God that comes from the southwest. Isaiah's list relates to cities from the north. And you could picture perhaps somebody at that time saying, well, you prophets can't even agree where the attack's going to come from. And it turns out that, well, both of them are right, that the city is besieged both ways. And again, ultimately, Hezekiah does trust God. He listens to Isaiah's counsel. Again, not too little too late, but very little, quite late, but still enough for God to deliver Hezekiah and the city of Jerusalem. Now, lest we get too excited about that, we have to keep in mind that that still meant the nation was utterly devastated. The entire nation of Judah was controlled by the Assyrians and just destroyed. They took whatever wasn't nailed down. Sennacherib catalogs 46 fortified cities of Judah he destroys. But we know there's one he didn't, and that was Jerusalem. And now, of course, he doesn't write in here, well, I was a miserable failure because the God of Judah was greater than, you know, me. But there is a kind of roundabout way in which he acknowledges his defeat. So he says, part of this is, as to Hezekiah the Jew, he did not submit to my yoke. I laid siege to 46 of his strong cities, walled forts, and countless small villages. In their vicinity, conquered them by means of well-stamped earth ramps and battering rams brought near to the walls, combined with the attack by foot soldiers using mines, breaches, as well as sapper work. I drove out of them 200,150 people. So in other words, 200,000 people of the population of Judah were deported as slaves, young and old, male and female. Horses, mules, donkeys, camels, big and small cattle, beyond counting, considered them booty. Himself I made a prisoner in Jerusalem, his royal residence, like a bird in a cage. And then, you know, he goes on to talk about that. But, you know, clearly he doesn't say, I conquered Jerusalem, I arrested Hezekiah. All he can say is, I cooped him up like a bird in a cage, which is a tacit admission he didn't conquer Jerusalem. And that's a kind of roundabout testimony to what the biblical story here tells us about Sennacherib and his relative success here. So, yes, God does deliver the nation, but at a horrendous cost. And you just think, what might have been different had they trusted in the Lord completely from the very beginning? And then one final thing. We talked about the city of Lachish, or Lachish, down here to the southwest. This is kind of an aerial view of the mound where the city is located. And down here is where the remnants of an Assyrian siege ramp can be seen. And that's remnants of what's left of it today. There's also a mass grave of some 1,500 people that were buried here because of the aftermath of the devastation. But one of the interesting things about this, Lachish was probably the second most important heavily fortified city in Judah. So it's, you know, second in importance only to Jerusalem. And it's in the way, guarding the route up to Jerusalem. And so the Assyrians want to attack it and conquer it. And the Assyrians are able to do that. And apparently they were so proud of their success that when Sennacherib gets back home, he has a whole room in his palace decorated with this frieze, this rock carving, about 100 linear feet of pictures of the siege of Lachish. And it's really fascinating because it intersects with biblical history, of course. But it also is one of the primary testimonies, contemporary testimonies, what ancient siege warfare is like. And so you can see an armored battering ram down here that they're pushing up with the pointed spear end to kind of chip away at whatever they're battering. And you can see all these torches and rocks and things that the defenders are throwing down on the enemy trying to, repel them. And there's a lot of other pictures as well, people being skinned alive and impaled on stakes. It's a lot of things the Assyrians like to do. So that's what you do for a relaxing picture in your dining room if you're an Assyrian emperor, I guess. So, all right, well, that's kind of big picture. I just wanted to kind of give that overview. Any questions about that, or does that provoke any thoughts or comments? Charlie?
Is there any significance to the length of narrative given to Hezekiah, mainly in retrospect back to Ahab and the Elijah story?
Yes, I mean, I think you ask ultimately what's the lesson of the Hezekiah story. You know, you're talking about people that are already in exile. They've been carried away into Babylon. Some prophet is writing this record down, this history of their what happened to them, to kind of explain to them how we got where we are. And so the Hezekiah story is a kind of a what might have been. Could things have been different? And I think the lesson here is, no, not really. Because he is a good king. And it's just like the rot in Judah goes so deep, you know. And ultimately, I think one of the messages of the whole Samuel King story is there has got to be a king that can do this. You know, God promised there would be a seed of David who was going to reign on his throne securely and forever. And this is as good as human effort is getting us. David was not the answer. Solomon's not the answer, and so on. And of course, by the time they're carried off into Babylon, you don't even have a king anymore. And you never have a king again. So where's the promise of God? Where is the seed of David who's going to fill this purpose and this promise God has made? And again, I think it's one of those things that ultimately points us to Jesus, you know, in the big picture sense. Well, that's a good question. I mean, you know, there's, you know, widespread devastation. You know, of course, Manasseh is going to reign for 55 years, and there'll be an occasion to regroup or reaccumulate some wealth and some population and things like that. But, That's a good question. You know, you get that problem of numbers because the Hebrew word elef, which we translate as thousand, it is clearly is often used just as a group, which doesn't necessarily have a thousand people in it. So, you know, like a battalion, you know, so it may the numbers may actually be small. But I don't know about cuneiform, whether that's the same thing or not. They are Semitic, so it may be the same. Same thing applies. Yes, I think so. And it is also, I think, intentionally put out of order because it will end with Hezekiah being presented in a negative light. He does let pride go to his head. He trusts again. I mean, he's been delivered, you know, from the power of the Assyrians at some point again, maybe again after this. But at this point, certainly, he's his reliance is in the political, or his reliance is in the political alliances that he can form. And that's kind of the last word about Hezekiah. You know, so it's not flattering. It's not like he did a few bad things, but hey, he's a great reformer. He did wonderful things, and let's end on a positive note. You know, kind of like at someone's funeral, you're giving a eulogy. You don't dredge up all the bad things they did. You know, you talk more positively about it. But here the record is told in such a way as to leave the story with Hezekiah as something of a disappointment. And I think that's intentional. All right, well, we have a few minutes then to kind of actually look at the text here and see what we can make of this. I'll try not to rehash the details of what's going on here. Of course, the king of Assyria carried Israel away into exile because they did not obey the voice of Yahweh their God, but transgressed his covenant. All that Moses, the servant of Yahweh, commanded, they would not listen or do it. And again, the people reading this story for the first time are in exile in Babylon. And they're saying, yep, that's us too. You know, so what happened to Israel is going to happen to Judah. They already know that. The reader already knows that. So it's a way of reinforcing that lesson. So now we're going to see as the story unfolds whether it's any different for Judah. And of course, it's not going to be. So in the 14th year of King Hezekiah, so 701 B.C., Sennacherib came up and besieged the fortified cities of Judah. Hezekiah sent to the king of Assyria at Lachish, saying, I have done wrong. Withdraw from me. Whatever you impose on me, I will bear. So the king of Assyria required of Hezekiah, king of Judah, 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold. So he's going to pay tribute to the Assyrians to withdraw. And Hezekiah gave him all the silver which was found in the house of Yahweh and in the treasuries of the king's house. Hezekiah cut off the gold from the doors of the temple of Yahweh and from the doorposts which Hezekiah, king of Judah, had overlaid and gave it to the king of Assyria. Now, there's one thing you can take to the bank, speaking about gold and silver here. Anytime treasures were stripped from the temple, it's never a good thing. You know, this is never a positive sign. Nothing good ever comes out of it. Hezekiah is not being commended here for his resourcefulness, you know. Oh, it's just a building. Strip off all things of value and get yourself out of a scrape here. This is yet another kind of piece of evidence of Hezekiah being more impressed by the political reality of the situation and trusting in money to buy his way out of this problem as opposed to just trust the Lord. He'll take care of his temple and his people if we will trust him. Well, does it work? Well, there's something of a gap between verses 16 and 17. Something happened. You know, we don't know what all, whether this is years later or 5 minutes later, the impression you get from the way the story is told is it didn't do Hezekiah any good. So he's actually worse off anyway. You know, it's kind of like if you've made a pact with some lying, murdering scumbag and you're shocked then that he, you know, stabs you in the back or betrays you or something, right? What do you expect? So the king of Assyria sends these three high-ranking officials, Tartan, Rabsaris, and Rabshakeh, from Lachish up to Jerusalem with a large army behind them. And they went up and stood by the conduit of the upper pool, which is on the highway of the washer's or launderer's field, which is interesting. This is the same place that Isaiah was sent to talk to Ahaz, Hezekiah's father, back in Isaiah chapter 7. And they called to the king. Now, the king's not actually there, but his representatives, Eliakim, who's the major domo or grand vizier, we would call him. Those aren't big words. You know, they're in the Lion King, and, you know, Jafar was a grand vizier, so shouldn't be too big of words for kids anyway. But he's the guy that runs the nation. He's the king's right-hand man. Shebna the scribe and Joah the recorder. So you got three great officials of the Assyrians. You got these three officials of the Judeans. And so notice then what Rabshakeh says. Say now to Hezekiah, thus says the great king, the king of Assyria. So Sennacherib is dignified with these great titles. Hezekiah is just Hezekiah. He's not even King Hezekiah, right? What is this trust that you have? You say, but they're only empty words, I have counsel and strength for war. On whom do you rely that you have rebelled against me? Behold, you rely on the staff of this crushed reed, Egypt, on which if a man leans, it will go into his hand and pierce it. So is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to all who rely on him. And this seems to be a legitimate observation by Reb Shekhar. He has inside knowledge of these political alliances of Judah that they've made with the Egyptians. Isaiah talks about this at great length in chapters 30 and 31 of his book, of the foolishness of Judah trusting in the military might of Egypt, which is just a shadow of its former self. And if you say to me, we trust in Yahweh our God, is it not he whose high places and altars Hezekiah has taken away and said to Judah and Jerusalem, you shall worship before this altar in Jerusalem? You can't worship these places. You got to worship here. And that again reflects some inside knowledge that this clearly is a point of a sore spot between some of the people. They like the high places. They're upset with Hezekiah for doing away with them. And Rabshakeh's playing on that raw nerve and trying to alienate Hezekiah from any potential supporters out there. He's trying to wear down the determination of the people to resist and to get them to capitulate, surrender. That'd be easier than carrying on the siege. Now therefore come, make a bargain with my master, the king of Assyria. I'll give you 2,000 horses if you are able on your part to set riders on them. That's a pretty brash, in-your-face move. I'll give you, it's like the equivalent of tanks, I'll give you tanks to fight me with if you got soldiers who can drive them, So how then can you repulse one official of the least of my master's servants and rely on Egypt for chariots and horsemen? So he's got a series of arguments, but the real doozy is verse 25. Have I now come up without Yahweh's approval against this place to destroy it? Yahweh said to me, go up against this land and destroy it. Which sounds like a pretty brazen claim by a pagan. But this was true. That's what Isaiah says in Isaiah chapter 10. Assyria is the rod of my anger. I have chosen them to chastise my people. Now whether Rabshakeh really knew that or had consulted with Isaiah or something like that, he probably is just speaking out of his arrogance. But it's one of those cases where he speaks more truly than he realizes as a result. But it really is God's intention that Assyria chastise Judah. But of course, Isaiah's whole point in Isaiah 10 is that does not absolve Assyria of her crimes, her sin, of horrible things she does in waging the war that she does. Well, at this point is when the servants say, speak to us in Aramaic. We understand Aramaic just fine. Don't speak in Hebrew where the people on the wall can listen. And of course, Rabshakeh is like, what do you think I'm doing this for? Of course I'm going to speak in Hebrew. My purpose is to undermine the will of the people. Has my master sent me only to your master and to you to speak these words, not to the men who sat on the wall doomed to eat their own dung and drink their own urine with you? Which is what happens in a siege when there's no food left and you get desperate enough. And so Rabshakeh stood and cried with a loud voice, hear the word of the great king, the king of Assyria. Do not let Hezekiah deceive you, for he will not be able to deliver you from my hand. And that's another true statement. Hezekiah cannot deliver the people. Nor let Hezekiah make you trust in Yahweh, saying, Yahweh will surely deliver us, and this city will not be given into the hand of the king of Assyria. Do not listen to Hezekiah, for thus says the king of Assyria, make your peace with me, come out to me, eat each one of his vine and his fig tree, and drink each of the waters of his own cistern, until I come and take you away to a land like your own land, a land of grain and new wine, flowing with milk and honey, you can almost hear him saying, right? A land of bread and vineyards, a land of olive trees and honey, that you may live and not die. I set before you today life and death, choose life that you may live. I mean, you practically hear the Lord saying these things to Israel in their past history. And I think that's intentional because the practical purpose of this speech, of course, is to drive a wedge between Hezekiah and any support he has by the popular people at large. Theologically, however, it raises a couple of very interesting questions. What is the basis of your trust? That's what Rabshakeh had asked, and that's exactly the question to ask. Is your trust in Yahweh or not? And who can deliver you? That's another question he asks. Now, of course, he means that in a, well, the answer obviously is nobody. You have no choice but to surrender to Sennacherib, the great king of Assyria. Well, no, Yahweh can deliver you. And ultimately, who is the true God who can deliver? Is it Sennacherib? Is he the one that provides the promised land of milk and honey? Or is it God who can provide what you need? And so his arrogance here is really something. But do not listen when he misleads you, saying, Yahweh will deliver us. Has any one of the gods of the nations delivered his land from the hand of the king of Assyria? Where are the gods of Hamath and Arpad? Where are the gods of Shepharim and Hinna and Iva? Have they delivered Samaria from my hand? So even Israel, they're also Yahweh worshipers, aren't they? And Yahweh didn't deliver Israel from my hand. Who among all the gods of the lands have delivered their land from my hand that Yahweh should deliver Jerusalem from my hand? And of course, the king had given instruction, don't answer, and he'll take this matter to the Lord, right? So excellent example of a manipulative, persuasive kind of speech here by Rabshakeh. So he gained his position, I think, based on some talent he had for political speech and rabble-rousing, but some powerful arguments here. And so how do you counter, you know, that? And, of course, Hezekiah is going to say ultimately, well, of course, the gods of these other nations were just gods of wood and stone. They weren't real gods at all, but Yahweh is the one true God, and he will deliver us. So any comments here in chapter 18? I don't want to run over this too quickly. But chapter 19 is the record, of course, of how Hezekiah responds to this predicament. He sends a contingent of people to Isaiah, which is telling in and of itself. He doesn't say, Isaiah, come see the king. You know, the king summons you to appear. You go see Isaiah. Verse 3, this is a day of distress, rebuke, and rejection, for children have come to birth, and there's no strength to deliver. Perhaps Yahweh, your God, will hear all the words of Rabshakeh, whom his master, the king of Assyria, sent to reproach the living God, and will rebuke the words which Yahweh, your God, has heard. Therefore, offer a prayer for the remnant that is left. And it's interesting because this word for defying God is used very rarely. But one of the places it occurs is, of course, David's comment about how Goliath defied the living God. And so you might even get a little echo here of how Hezekiah is being like his father David. And when he hears the defiant words of this uncircumcised pagan Gentile, calls upon God to defend his own name and do something about this. But notice again the last part of verse 4, pray for this remnant. And that's, again, the first people to read this story are a remnant in exile. And it's a reassurance that God will hear the prayers on behalf of the remnant and will ultimately bring them back. If we go back to 1 Kings chapter 8, when Solomon dedicated the temple, he had prayed, you know, when we sin and you carry us into captivity in a foreign land, if we will turn toward this place, this temple, and pray to you and repent, forgive and bring us back. And again, the first people to read that are in that very situation. So there is hope, you know, scattered throughout this abysmal story. There's no hope that they're not going to get deported because that's already happened. But there is hope of what can happen once they are in exile and how God will bring them back. And so what happens is Isaiah gives a reassurance. I'm going to put a spirit in Sennacherib. He will hear a rumor, return to his own land. I will make him fall by the sword in his own land. And so what happens, which may give the appearance of the early fulfillment of this, is Rabshakeh goes back and finds the king of Assyria fighting against Libnah, So he's left Lachish to go take on another challenge somewhere. He's got another military fire to put out somewhere. And when he heard them say concerning Tirhaka, king of Cush, so again, from Ethiopia or whoever was the Pharaoh in Egypt at the time, behold, he has come out to fight against you. He sent messengers again to Hezekiah saying, basically, don't get your hopes up. This is just a minor glitch. The Assyrian army is going to go take care of this and we'll be back, you know. So Jerusalem still is not going to escape. And again, did the gods of the nations which my fathers destroyed deliver them? Of course not. Look at history, the handwriting's on the wall. So Hezekiah takes this letter that was sent to him, this, again, arrogant, kind of threatening letter, he takes it to the temple, lays it out before the Lord, and offers up this prayer, O Yahweh, God of Israel, who is enthroned above the cherubim, you are God, you alone, of all the kingdoms of the earth, you made heaven and earth. Incline your ear, O Yahweh, and hear. Open your eyes, O Yahweh, and see. Listen to the words of Sennacherib, which he has sent to defy the living God. Yes, the kings of Assyria have devastated the nations and their lands and cast their gods in the fire, for they were not gods, but the work of men's hands, wood and stone, so they destroyed them. And the implication, of course, is you are not this. You are the true God. And now, O Yahweh our God, I pray, deliver us from his hand that all the kingdoms of the earth may know you alone, O Yahweh, our God. And so Isaiah then gives a response in which he indicts the arrogance of Assyria, and God will chastise Assyria and bring them down. Verse 28, because of your raging against me, because your arrogance has come up to my ears, I will put my hook in your nose, my bridle in your lips, and I will turn you back by the way which you came. And so there's a message of hope. The Assyrians are going to remove. The nation will recover. The first year you're going to eat. You'll have plenty to eat just from what grows by itself because the land's going to be pretty devastated. The second year, what springs from the same in the third year, there will actually be natural sowing and reaping and planting of vineyards and the produce that will come. But Assyria will not succeed in its siege of Jerusalem. He will leave and go back. I will defend the city. And so verse 35, it happened that night, the angel of Yahweh went out and struck 185,000 in the camp of the Assyrians. And what few were left got up in the morning like, man, everybody's dead. And so Sennacherib goes back to Nineveh. And it came about as he was worshiping in the house of Nisroch his god, Adrammelech and Sharezer, his own sons, killed him with a sword, and they escaped into the land of Ararat, and Esarhaddon, his son, became king in his place. And the Babylonians made a big to-do of this because Sennacherib had sacked the city of Babylon, which was a holy city. They saw this as a divine judgment of the gods against Sennacherib, that his own sons would assassinate him in a coup attempt. Wasn't successful. Obviously, they had to escape, but you know, that's what his end was eventually here. Now, this is actually several years later. It didn't happen like the next day. But it's an interesting, you need to remember that the word messenger and angel is the same word, right? So Sennacherib has sent his messengers to Hezekiah to threaten their worst, which all comes to naught, right? God sends one messenger of his, and he can take out 185,000 in the blink of an eye. And that's just, again, a comparison of the kind of strength of Sennacherib as God, as one who can deliver versus the one true God. And I want to read one passage in Isaiah chapter 10, and this is part of that section where Isaiah is acknowledging that Assyria is the rod of God's anger. I see it's past time. I didn't hear a bell, so it was... I see. Well, you got to stop me with a bell. I respond to nothing else. I'll start salivating even. All right. Well, I'll end with verse 12. So it will be that when the Lord has completed all his work on Mount Zion and Jerusalem, he will say, I will punish the fruit of the arrogant heart of the king of Assyria and the pomp of his haughtiness. And that's a passage that's explicitly about Sennacherib, that God would punish his pride and bring it to naught. So, yeah, I just thought Charlie's back there wanting to ask a question or something. But eventually, any final comments or other than Tom, will you please sit down and be quiet? I'll do that. So, well, thank you for your attention.